Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the Smoke on the Water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kotz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to discuss the phenomenon of the musical supergroup.
Plus, later on in the show, we'll review the new album from rapper Mos Def.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by founding sponsor Alltech Lansing, creating speaker systems for the iPod and the computer, allowing music fans to listen critically. Online at alltechlansing.com. Hear what's next.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
中国加油！十三亿激情，敢为中国红！
Greg, there's something different for Sound Opinions. That is a commercial that aired in China for Pepsi Red. It's a version of Pepsi Cola that was originated in Japan. Has a ginger flavor to it, sold in a red can. The reason we're talking about this is that Pepsi Cola is getting into the record business in China. It is starting a record label, Q Music, that is designed to groom, produce, and ultimately control the recording stars for the Chinese listening public. They figure it is going to be a lot better than buying pop stars' songs to put into commercials over there. They're going to create their own. It is stemming out of a TV show that they're already producing, which is a sort of Battle of the Bands thing. It's called Battle of the Bands. 10 different Chinese bands compete for prize money and a recording deal with Pepsi. We saw this recently in the States at a much lower key level with Mountain Dew recording several bands, including Chicago's hip-hop crew, the Cool Kids. But they have much bigger goals overseas. I mean, China is the market, right?
It's unbelievable. It is. It's a huge population, obviously. It's also the wild, wild west of the music industry. I mean, nobody really has figured out how to sell records in China because the rogue market over there is unbelievable for bootlegs, downloading, file sharing. It's just going crazy. Nobody's ever figured out how to really monetize the great amount of music activity going on. But Pepsi's going to try. At the end of this year, apparently, the winner of the Battle of the Bands reality show is going to be featured in a commercial for Pepsi. And it's going to be sort of this American Idol-type franchise where they try to build an audience
for this Idol band.
Yeah, exactly. But whether they're going to be able to sell any music for this band is another question entirely.
I'm still stumbling over ginger-flavored cola.
She's a mixed-up, shook-up girl, got me so strong, I don't know what to do. She's a mixed-up, shook-up girl.
That's Mixed-Up, Shook-Up Girl, a track from a band known as Mink DeVille, led by one Willie DeVille. The reason we're playing it is that Willie DeVille has died at age 58 of pancreatic cancer, probably not a household name. Didn't have any U.S. hits, but I wanted to spotlight him, Jim, because I thought he was one of the key artists of that CBGB punk new wave scene out in New York in the mid-70s. An artist with a difference. I mean, he was lumped in alongside Blondie and the Talking Heads and the Ramones and Television, but I think he was really a child more of that brill-building pop sound combined with soul and R&B of the late 50s and early 60s.
Yep.
And he really updated that sound for a new generation. Was featured on one of the first CBGB live compilations. That's where he rose to fame initially and caught the ear of one Jack Nitzsche, who was the right-hand man of Phil Spector on many of his early 60s recordings. So Nitzsche went into the studio with Mink DeVille, Willie DeVille's band, and recorded three extraordinary albums, starting with Cabretta in 1977. Loved this guy, worked with him in the studio, updated that sound that Spector made famous in the early 60s. With DeVille as the lead vocalist, this guy had style, man. You saw him on stage, and he had the sharpest suits and those Italian shoes.
And that mustache.
And that pencil-thin mustache. He looked good. I remember distinctly going to a show, and we were all dancing because we loved the music. It was very romantic kind of music for that era. Brought our girlfriends, and I think by the end of the show, Willie DeVille was hitting on every one of our girlfriends and probably stole two or three of them away at the time.
Well, what I loved about him, Greg, is that he was one of a handful of artists who Rockpile in the UK were another that kind of drew the lines. This punk explosion didn't come out of nowhere. It had its roots. There were Cajun guys in the 50s mm-hmm. who were punk rock.
Right.
There was Edith Piaf was punk rock in a way, and it was like a history lesson for those of us young, you know, Turks who just thought it all got invented with the Ramones.
Exactly. I mean, he was the guy that introduced me to the music of Doc Pomus and those Lieber Stoller songs.
Dr. John.
Brill Building. Yes, he worked with Dr. John later on in his career. Mark Knopfler later produced a record for him. But I think the ground zero for Mink DeVille was Cabretta, the 1977 debut produced by Jack Nitzsche. And here's one of the best songs off it, Spanish Stroll by the late, great Willie DeVille on Sound Opinions.
Mr. Jim, I can see the shape you're in. Finger on your eyebrow and left hand on your hip. Thinking that you're such a lady killer. Think you're so slick. Well, all right. Brother Johnny, he caught a plane and he got on it. Now he's a razor in the wind, and he's got a pistol in his pocket. They say the man is crazy on the coast. Lord, there ain't no doubt about it. Well, all right. What are we gonna do? And she said, take two candles and then you burn them out. Make a paper boat, light it and send it out. Send it out now.
Spanish Stroll by Mink DeVille. Willie DeVille, the band leader, dead at 58.
Don't you forget about me. Don't, don't, don't.
Craig, I think it is impossible to hear that song, Don't You, by Simple Minds, and not think of that film, The Breakfast Club, from 1985, a classic movie that really defined the teenage experience in the 80s. I was a teenager when I saw all those films by John Hughes. It was my life. I was the geek. I was the Michael Anthony Hall. As you probably know, John Hughes died a little more than a week ago, had a heart attack in New York. A sad story, but I think he's important to remember as a great music lover, a big fan, and a guy who really perfected the combination of sound and vision in that string of films he made in the 80s. He was performing a huge service, Greg, when you recall that the just post-punk, with the big flowering of new wave in the UK and stuff bubbling under in the underground in America, that stuff was not being played on radio.
Right.
Certainly outside of New York and Los Angeles. A lot of people discovered this kind of alternative music, the full blossoming of which would happen in the 90s via John Hughes films. And you think about the string of pairings of great songs and scenes in his movies, you know, True by Spandau Ballet or Turning Japanese by the Vapors in 16 Candles in 84, or the use of Oh Yeah by Yellow in Ferris Bueller's Day Off in 86. I mean, classic stuff.
In 1999, when we were just starting the show on another station, Jim, we got John Hughes into the studio with us to talk about music, and it was an extraordinary conversation. It was a tough interview in terms of just being able to get him to talk about anything, but when it came to music, he could talk all night about
yeah.
it. And in fact, those days when he was trolling the aisles at Wax Trax Records on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago, looking for those new wave and post-punk imports, those were some of the happiest days of his life. And those songs and those records that he bought at that store, they were kind of like writing the script with him. And even to the very end, I mean, we're talking about a guy in 1999 who made this movie, Reach the Rock, in which he completely used the post-rock music that was bubbling through Chicago at that time, you know, bands like Tortoise and Sea and Cake. So he was always interested in what was new, what was underground, and figuring out a way to build movies around. I think really extraordinary legacy for a director.
Well, absolutely. He did one of those things that too few people in rock do. After reaching a point of extraordinary success, he decided he'd had enough, and he went on to just live his life. And, you know, was not really seen in the public eye for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was really rare that he spent 2 hours with us on the radio show in its previous incarnation, and it was only because he wanted to talk about music, and then we couldn't shut him up. That's why we want to pay tribute to him. I think the perfect song is Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs. He probably discovered it at Wax Trax in 81 when it came out on their second album, Talk, Talk, Talk. It germinated the idea. He did not direct Pretty in Pink, the film. He wrote it and produced it, and he said that the song inspired the screenplay. The Psychedelic Furs wound up re-recording it, I think at the behest of the record company, in a somewhat inferior version. Let's play the version John Hughes fell in love with, the album version from 81. Here is the Psychedelic Furs with Pretty in Pink on Sound Opinions.
Joy loves and is raining all day. She loves to be one of the girls. She lives in a place in the side of our lives where nothing is ever but straight. She turns herself around.
Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs on Sound Opinions in honor of John Hughes, dead at 59.
Everybody got somebody to leave.
next to mine. Dream on. I've been uptight and made a mess, but I'll clean it up myself, I guess. Oh, the sweet smell of success handle me with care.
Handle with Care by the Traveling Wilburys. Why are we playing the Traveling Wilburys at this point? We wanted to look at this idea of the supergroup, where multiple band members from already famous bands get together and create a new group out of it, the supergroup. The Traveling Wilburys exhibit one in a lot of ways for this phenomenon. In the 80s, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, Jeff Lynne, George Harrison, and Tom Petty, five pretty big names already on their own, got together in a recording studio and made an album as the Traveling Wilburys. Later on, went made another album without Orbison, who had died at that point. But the point being that this is a phenomenon that has been going on through pop music history. We're going to look a little bit at that phenomenon today, but why is it on our mind this week, Jim?
I'll tell you why, because we were two of the luckiest people in the universe, the 1,100 people at Metro in Chicago at midnight on Sunday last week at the end of Lollapalooza, right? We had just spent 35 hours in Grant Park trying to cover as many of the 142 bands as possible playing that giant festival, sold out at 75,000 per day. We had talked a couple of weeks ago about how the Beastie Boys had to cancel their appearance at Lollapalooza and a couple of other big festivals because Adam Yauch was battling cancer. Apparently, the promoters tried to get this new supergroup, them Crooked Vultures, to take that slot. They liked the idea of coming to Chicago to play their first gig anywhere in the world, but they wanted it much more intimate. Mm-hmm. So they put out a fan club notice. They haven't played anywhere, but they already have a fan club, and a certain limited number of tickets went on sale. No press invited. How did we get in? Never mind. And we got to see this show. Who is this band? Dave Grohl of Nirvana and the Foo Fighters on drums. Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age and formerly Caius on vocals and guitar. And the mighty, the unbeatable John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin on bass. It had really been a rumor, this project, that Grohl had kind of dropped the idea years ago. Nobody ever thought it was really going to happen. And all of a sudden, they're playing for the first time anywhere in the world at this tiny club in Metro when they could have played to 75,000 people.
Yeah, Jim, it was a thrill to be there because it was a close range. It was like watching a bomb go off. Whenever you've got Grohl on drums, you know the energy level is going to pick up. You know, all due respect to the guy as a singer, guitar player, songwriter, where this guy really needs to belong is behind that drum kit driving a band. Hard rock, I don't think, does it justice. This was just some of the heaviest, hardest-hitting music I've heard in recent years, and Grohl was the guy making it go. And John Paul Jones bringing around this array of bass guitars.
I mean, started with a 4-string bass.
One looked like a bazooka.
Moved up to 6 strings, then 8 strings, then 10 strings, and then he was playing this thing that was like a lap steel bass guitar. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was fun to watch. And Josh Homme giving it a little bit of that Queen sound with those high falsetto vocals. But this was definitely a democracy. I mean, I don't think this band would have sounded the way it did if you didn't have those three personalities in the room at one time.
We're talking about it instead of playing it, I should say, because while there's apparently an album recorded, the band played 12 songs, no encore. That apparently is the whole album. It does not yet have a label, does not yet have a release date. There's no music out there. We literally can't play. The best thing you'll find anywhere on the net is a couple of cell phone snippets of video from that show. But boy, Grohl, of course, was the John Bonham of his generation in terms of a massive drummer. And Josh Homme, like so many people of that age group, grew up worshiping Led Zeppelin. So these guys, who have been excellent in their own groups, were really on their super best behavior and pushing themselves beyond their abilities even to reach some whole new level just because you're on stage with the bassist from Led Zeppelin.
And it's interesting because there is a huge trend in this area once again. We reviewed a few of these bands on the show where they have been amalgamations of other bands, you know, Tinted Windows with Bunny Carlos, Taylor Hanson, James Iha, Bunny with Cheap Trick, Taylor Hanson with Hanson, James Iha with the Smashing Pumpkins. We talked about Dead Weather with Jack White of the White Stripes meeting Alison Mosshart of the Kills. We've talked about the Raconteurs, another white band with Brendan Benson. We have neglected to mention Chickenfoot, I think.
I don't know how we did that. Sammy Hagar of Van Halen and Montrose, Michael Anthony of Van Halen, Chad Smith of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Joe Satriani, the superstar guitarist who hates Coldplay.
And Monsters of Folk is coming up with Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes, My Morning Jacket's Jim James, and M. Ward forming a band, going out on tour, releasing an album, and my favorite, Damnocracy. Sebastian Bach of Skid Row and Ted Nugent, who's Ted Nugent. He needs no introduction.
Well, we're going to come back, Greg, and talk about this whole twisted history of the supergroup from the 50s through the present. That's in a minute when we come back on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. And later on, we'll review the new album from rapper Mos Def. Back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That mercifully short clip of sound was the new supergroup, Chickenfoot. We are talking about the history of supergroups and the ones that worked and the ones that didn't on Sound Opinions today. Greg, I got a theory about supergroups, as I often do, right, on these things. So Sammy, Mike, Joe, and Chad get together. they play in the basement, right? They're just any Sammy, Joe, Mike, and Chad. And who cares? Maybe it clicks and maybe it doesn't. Why, when all of a sudden they're Sammy Hagar, Michael Anthony, Joe Satriani, and Chad Smith, is there a better chance of that band working as a group? You know, in order for a supergroup to work, I think it presumes two things. Number one, that these people really are super. And I would say, all due respect to the records he sold, that Sammy Hagar, or Michael Anthony for that matter, in any incarnation, are not all that super as far as a larger-than-life rock talent. But number two, why would you think, just because you put them in front of, like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers drummer and Joe Satriani, that there is any chemistry? You know, bands, no matter how talented the individual members are and how much of a reputation they have in other contexts, they're not necessarily going to work together.
Sometimes, though, Jim, you have to look at these supergroups as happening out of thin air. It's almost an accident that they happen. I think lately we've seen much more calculated reasons for supergroups to get together. You know, there's money involved. Back in 1956, I don't think there was such a thing as a supergroup. It certainly wasn't on Sam Phillips' mind, the great producer in Memphis at Sun Studios, when he was doing a session with Carl Perkins. Perkins was coming off of Blue Suede Shoes. He was looking to record a follow-up hit. In the studio at the time was a fledgling piano player desperate for work, a guy named Jerry Lee Lewis. And then Sam Phillips' greatest find up to that point, Elvis Presley, just happens to be cruising the neighborhood with his girlfriend and decides to drop into the studio. And next thing he gets on the phone with Johnny Cash and says, "Hey, Johnny, you might want to come down to the studio. We got a few people in here you might want to see." A couple of his old pals. Cash had already had a couple of hits as well for Sun Records. Phillips makes one more phone call. Calls a reporter at the local daily newspaper and has him come by with a photographer to capture, document this event. But Phillips, to his credit, perhaps eternally, just rolls some tape and says, boys, we're having fun. You know, we got this photo op. We'll take a photo and you guys do whatever you want to do. And basically what he did was preserve a moment in time where you had these four soon-to-be legendary figures in the studio at one time just bantering, going back and forth, trading songs, basically trading the songs that they grew up on. Mostly gospel songs, a lot of old blues, R&B, doo-wop, vocal group type stuff, and just having a ball in the studio. So it's kind of, talk about being a fly on the wall at one of the most important historical events of musical history of the last 50 years. That's basically what Sam Phillips provided.
Goes on to be called the Million Dollar Quartet. That's how it goes down to history. And really, the birth of rock and roll, as well as the birth of the supergroup, is what you had in that room.
Yeah, and what's amazing about it, Jim, again, is that Phillips didn't really knuckle down and say, you know, guys, give me a song. But there were a few moments where things came together, and you can hear Elvis, who takes most of the lead vocals here. Cash really didn't participate so much in the musical aspect of it. He was there mostly to observe. But Perkins was on guitar, certainly, and Lewis was banging out that piano and also inserting himself on the vocals, making sure that people knew, I'm here.
He doesn't take a backseat to anybody.
So you can hear it on this particular song, Just a Little Talk with Jesus, where you hear the Million Dollar Quartet in action in 1956 on Sound Opinions.
Just a Little Talk with Jesus. Remember that? I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in. Better than a little light from heaven filled my soul. Then he made my heart in love, and I wrote my name above. Well, just a little talk with my Jesus gonna make me right.
Just have a little talk with Jesus. I tell him all about my troubles.
He will hear our faintest cry, he will answer. Well, when you will feel a little fire will turn, and you will know a little fire's burning, you will find a little talk with Jesus makes it right.
Let's roll it up, come on.
You may have doubts and fears, your eyes be filled with tears. Oh, now my Jesus is a friend who watches day and night.
Yeah.
Well, he wrote my name above, and he made my heart in love. Well, just a little talk with my Jesus gonna make it right.
Just a Little Talk with Jesus by the Million Dollar Quartet from the 50s from Sun Records. We wanted to bring that in, Greg, because I think most people believe that the idea of the supergroup began in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think that it was already, the template was already there.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. And I think that the stakes changed. You know, fast forward 10 years to the 60s, and you saw a whole different set of concerns and pressures being involved. When you saw the group Cream form in England in the mid-60s, there was already this idea that we're going to take these name brand players and form a great group out of it. Eric Clapton was really well known in England at the time. He'd already spent time in the Yardbirds and with John Mayall's Blues Breakers. His future bandmates in Cream, Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, were less known, but they were really respected musicians. They had been together in this band, the Graham Bond Organization. And they bonded together, formed the Cream, and within a couple of years were a multi-million selling group that was playing arenas around the world and selling tons of records. At the same time, Clapton in this experience was really miserable because Bruce and Baker were constantly fighting, and there was a sense that the music was now about three guys up on stage soloing their brains out and no longer involved in music making for music making's sake. It was more about individual egos rather than the song. You know, I think Clapton and I think history to an extent have taken a sort of jaded view about just how good this band was. But if you listen to the studio recordings, I think there was some excellent, excellent music made by this band. I think the songwriting was really top-notch, much of it by Jack Bruce. Bruce was an astonishingly good vocalist. And Clapton, I think, has never been better because he wasn't asked to carry the major load as the vocalist and frontman. He's always been best when he's been surrounded by talents that are his equal and he's allowed to play the guitar.
Yeah.
And I think he did that very, very well in Cream, especially on those studio recordings.
Coming to me in the
But nonetheless, the band broke up in 68, and he was already forging a bond with Steve Winwood, a guy he'd admired for a long time as the vocalist in the Spencer Davis group and in a new group called Traffic. Winwood was 3 years younger than Clapton. Consider that Clapton was 23 years old at the time. Winwood was a mere 20. And Clapton's looking at this guy and says, you know, I really want to make music with this guy. I want to do something lower key. Mm-hmm. I want to do something that is less about this stadium-level mega band that Cream had become and do something more intimate. So that was the initial idea with Winwood. But what we can see here is the corrupting influence of major labels and money. Because the group that Clapton formed with Winwood and later on Ginger Baker called Blind Faith was a supergroup times 10. The band quickly went into the studio, made a record, and their first show was in Hyde Park in the summer of 1969 in front of 100,000 people.
No pressure in that kind of debut.
No pressure. Clapton's going, what have I gotten myself into? I went from one quote-unquote supergroup into another in no time at all. The music never really had any time to incubate. They never really got a chance to become the great live band that Clapton thought that they could become. So within 6 or 7 months, he had left Blind Faith as well. But they left behind some extraordinary music. Again, there was 3 or 4 songs on that first Blind Faith album, the first and only Blind Faith album, that are really extraordinary. And it was a chance here where, you know, if this group had been given a little time to develop, they could have created something really amazing. But as it was, we're left with just this one record.
Come down off your throne and leave your body alone. Somebody must change.
But I think, Greg, as extraordinary as Blind Faith was, I think when you talk about supergroups from the 60s, you've got to look at Crosby, Stills, and Nash, plus sometimes Young.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that these three musicians who had all had some success already, David Crosby as a member of the Byrds, Stephen Stills in Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash with the Hollies, it was kind of a loosey-goosey thing. You know, everybody's hanging around getting stoned in the 60s at a party at Cass Elliot's house, Mama Cass Elliot. And these three guys start harmonizing, and the idea is born. Now, that's the simplified, let's all go back to the garden version of it, right? In fact, obviously, they had all had careers. They had all had careers in bands where they had been underappreciated, they felt. Crosby taking a backseat to Roger McGuinn and the Byrds, Stills obviously having to play behind Neil Young fronting Buffalo Springfield. So they all want to be stars, and they decide they're going to do it together. And therein lies the problem of Crosby, Stills, and Nash throughout their entire four-decade now history. At various times, any two or three have been mad at the others. You know, going back to my theories of why supergroups work and why they don't, obviously, Crosby, Stills, and Nash made some fine music, and those are three wonderful voices. When you combine, it really is an instrument that is bigger than all three of them. So it works on the musical level. Doesn't quite work on the personal level all the time. In fact, sometimes I think it's a little syrupy what they've done. Now, all of a sudden, they decide in 69 they need another ingredient. First, they're thinking, let's bring in that Steve Winwood guy on keyboards. He's already been in a couple of supergroups. The heck with that. They're managed by a guy named Elliot Roberts, who makes the suggestion, you need Neil Young. I was watching one of those public broadcasting specials about Neil Young the other night, and it struck me, seeing him play with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, it's like it's a fine dish that is missing something, and all of a sudden you put in, you know, the cumin or the paprika, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, now it's something. Because Neil really can't sing as well as those three harmonizing guys.
Right.
But you look at the version of, say, Teach Your Children that they recorded
before Neil. And then you look at the version from the live album, Four Way Street, with Neil, mm-hmm. and it's much, much better. They make their debut with Neil Young at Woodstock right. in 1969. And through all the years that have followed, Young kind of comes in when he feels like it.
Right.
You know, and when he doesn't, he's gone. And those other guys all kind of fall apart without him. They all wind up feuding with each other. Sometimes Crosby plays with Stills and sometimes Nash plays with, you know, and it's like they can't hold it together. But when you add the Y, you got something special. Let's listen to a little bit of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Let's hear that version of Teach Your Children that he wound up playing on from Four Way Street in 71.
Teach your children well. Their father's health did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by.
Everybody sing with us.
Don't you ever ask them why. If they told you, you would cry. So just look at them and sigh. And know they love you.
That's Teach Your Children from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And yes, Young, a very important ingredient here, because Crosby, Stills, and Nash did have a tendency to argue among themselves, but when you added the fourth person into the room at that point, who happened to be Neil Young, suddenly all the bickering went out of the way, and the focus became the music again. So you're absolutely right about that, Jim, in terms of the chemistry in the room and how one person can change it for the better or the worse.
Well, absolutely. And as you go into the 70s, the nature of the supergroup changes, Greg, after CSNNY, after Cream and Blind Faith. I think it's best illustrated in the progressive rock genre. By this point, you'd had all these English musicians who had had the first blush of success as members of these psychedelic pop groups that followed in the wake of the Beatles, right? Something like Emerson, Lake and Palmer comes out of the ashes of the Nice and the early King Crimson, right? And they're all three of them. They got billing right in the title of the band. They're all superstars. And basically, progressive rock was lousy with supergroups. Yes was a supergroup when it formed. Steve mm-hmm. Howe had been in Tomorrow, and Chris Squire had been in The Sin, both had big hits in the UK in the psychedelic era. But the progressive rock supergroup I want to play to illustrate the 70s version of this came a little later, and none of the musicians were really A-listers, although they were all extraordinary talents. UK was a short-lived British supergroup from 77 through 80. It was founded by John Wetton, who had been the singer and bassist in King Crimson, and drummer of Bill Bruford, who'd also been in King Crimson and then in Yes, and then basically played with every prog rock band that ever did anything. The initial idea was to make a band with Rick Wakeman, but his label at the time wouldn't let the Yes keyboardist out of his solo project on top of being with Yes. They were each allowed to bring one other musician into the mix. Wetton brought in Eddie Jobson, who had played in Roxy Music, the electric violinist and keyboardist. And Bruford brought in Alan Holdsworth, the great jazz guitarist. UK made a couple of studio albums in that guise. I will admit, the first band I ever saw in an arena setting, UK was opening for Jethro Tull in 1979 when I saw them. At that point, Holdsworth was gone, and so was Bruford, but they had another superstar, drummer Terry Bozzio. This extraordinary young talent who had made his name at that point playing with Frank Zappa
mm-hmm.
would go on to play with Missing Persons, right? But so Wetton and Jobson and Bozzio on stage in an arena filled with people. I mean, it was, I guess, the first band I ever saw was a supergroup. Here is UK with the title track of that 79 live album, Night After Night, on Sound Opinions.
Darkness descends on the freeway. Traffic lines turning to
Night After Night from UK, one of the supergroups we're discussing today on Sound Opinions. To comment on supergroups or anything else we discuss on this show, call our hotline at 888-859-1800. You can also send us an email at interact@soundopinions.org or talk to us on Facebook. Jim and I are going to be back after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. We're inching our way into the modern era on supergroups, and we're also going to review the new album by Mos Def.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by Alltech Lansing. Online at alltechlansing.com.
Do you remember when we used to dance? And incidents arose from circumstance. One thing led to another, we were young. And we would string together songs unsung.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is Asia, of course. Everybody knows that song. You saw it in the
40-year-old Virgin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Heat of the moment. We are talking about supergroups, and there was an iconic supergroup of the early 80s. We've already talked about John Wetton, who is in one of Jim DeRogatis' favorite bands. We just found out about UK and King Crimson before that. Steve Howe and Jeff Downes, both of Yes in Asia, and Carl Palmer, who was kind of a supergroup whore in a lot of ways. He was
yeah.
he was an Emerson, Lake, and Palmer before this, and they were a supergroup.
Does it stop to be so super once you've been in three or four of them, you know?
Exactly, but nonetheless, Carl Palmer kept making the good commercial moves because Asia sold a lot of records back in the early 80s.
No, you're absolutely right. Look, I think that by the time you got to the 80s, the idea of a supergroup, especially in the underground rock world, was already a bit of a joke. Anton Fier was a very talented drummer who'd played in a number of wonderful settings, including the Feelies and then the Lounge Lizards, when he decided to put together basically a group of his friends in the New York and Hoboken, New Jersey underground music scene in the early 80s, and kind of making fun of, but at the same time paying tribute to, the idea of the supergroups that had come before. He in particular was inspired, I remember him telling me, by Blind Faith, mm-hmm. okay? So what he's doing is basically collecting the cream of the crop in the underground New York scene at the time in the early 80s. People like the vocalist Sid Straw, who went on to an extraordinary solo career, Michael Stipe of REM whenever he was in town, John Lydon of the Sex Pistols mm-hmm. and PIL. Anton even got Jack Bruce of Cream. People would come and go through the band he put together that was called the Golden Palominos. I really fell in love with the single they did. Michael Stipe of REM was on vocals. Chris Stamey of the DBs was on guitar. You had the great Jody Harris also adding guitar. It was a cover of a band from that earlier era. Mm-hmm. Moby Grape was in many ways in the 60s kind of a supergroup that was local to San Francisco. All these guys had reputations. You know, they were the band with three guitars.
Right.
They were the band that released every track on their debut album was a single that they all released simultaneously. And already you had, in the late 60s, people were reacting against that hype. Mm-hmm. Because of this stunt of releasing every song at one time as a single, people dismissed the record.
Right.
But there was an incredible song called Omaha that was resurrected later on in the early 80s by the Golden Palominos. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
Listen, my friend.
Omaha from the Golden Palominos on Sound Opinions. Supergroup that was created in the 80s and was kind of a fluid lineup. I think another example of a band that we started to see in the 80s, and especially Jim, was a disaffected band member uniting with another disaffected band member to create a new band because their old groups weren't working anymore.
Yeah.
And that was the case with Electronic. Bernard Sumner was not getting along with his bandmates in New Order anymore. That band was on hiatus. Johnny Marr had just seen the Smiths blow up when Morrissey, the singer, walked out of that band. Two talented guys looking for work. They bonded together, created Electronic, recorded a few albums together, actually had a kind of a successful run and a few hits, mostly in the UK.
I always thought of you as my brick wall, built like an angel, 6 feet tall.
Again, this sort of fluid, floating lineup that you could come and go as you chose, and a little bit more freedom, perhaps, than they had enjoyed in their previous groups. We go back to that million-dollar quartet model, too, when I think of a band like Temple of the Dog, which was basically an ad hoc band created to record a tribute album to Andrew Wood, a Seattle singer who had died of a heroin overdose. He had been in Mother Love Bone. Wood, a key figure in the Pacific Northwest music scene. And Chris Cornell of Soundgarden and his bandmate Matt Cameron got together in the studio with former Mother Love Bone musician Stone Gossard and Jeff Almet, as well as a couple of new guys in town, Eddie Vedder and Mike McCready,
yeah,
to just record a bunch of songs.
But it's on the table, the fire's cooking, and the farmer's babies and the slaves are all
But, you know, here was your 90s version of the Million Dollar Quartet as performed in Seattle.
Well, yeah, and then the 90s were lousy with it from that point on. You know, something like Mad Season or Fantomas,
yeah,
or the Backbeat Band, which got together for that Beatles movie soundtrack. And then I think kind of like the 90s ended in the mid-2000s with Audioslave,
right,
when Cornell is in front of the musicians from Rage Against the Machine, which nobody ever thought was a good idea of a supergroup.
Right, right. And it's interesting that this never really caught on in the hip-hop realm. The more commonplace thing is to see a cameo vocal. It did happen in the R&B world with a group called Lucy Pearl, a combination of Raphael Sadiq, who had been coming off a long run of hits with Tony Tone, Dawn Robinson, one of the vocalists in En Vogue, and Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest. Now, all of these groups had broken up. These three joined forces and made one pretty good record, a record that I think initially was not commercially all that well received, but I think over time, some of the deeper tracks on it, some of the non-singles, are gaining some traction, and people realize, hey, this group wasn't so bad. You know, it actually did some really good work. They were trying to forge a nice synthesis of street sounds, that hip-hop vibe, with an old-school R&B soul vibe. And I think they got about halfway there. I think if they had stuck around long enough to make another record, this group could have really been something. But as it is, we only have the one record. And here's a single from it, Don't Mess With My Man, on Sound Opinions.
Don't Mess With My Man on Sound Opinions by Lucy Pearl. Rare example of a supergroup that is deserving that appellation, which wraps up our look at supergroups this week.
Super magic, black origin, fresh me out of dopeness. Death me out of dopeness. Sketch another opus. Knock off this set, Brooklyn. We keep them open.
Heavens expand, the stars advance, the love will be man.
Hold your hand, healing power like bang. Snap our filthy snitches. We know the truth, you can't confuse me, bitch. Great name, greater than all your riches. Y'all Dante, Flacco Bay, that's the business.
That's Mos Def with a song called Super Magic from his new album, The Ecstatic. Known as Dante Terrell Smith to his mom when he was born in Brooklyn nearly 40 years ago. Mos Def has forged a pretty prominent career more as a Hollywood and TV actor than as a musician in recent years. Even though he started out making hip-hop records in the late 90s, the acting career sort of took over. He's been nominated for an Emmy Award, a Golden Globe. He's been in Be Kind, Rewind. He's been on The Chappelle Show, all the while making less and less interesting music. It started out pretty auspiciously in 1998 with a group called Black Star with Talib Kweli. Put Mos Def on the map as one of the most innovative MCs on the planet at the time, and he followed it up in 1999 with his solo debut, Black on Both Sides. Has he returned to form on his fourth album, The Ecstatic? Let's find out in a minute, but let's listen to a track first. It's called Life in Marvelous Times on Sound Opinions from Mos Def.
This is Bed-Stuy 82, ninth floor, three tiny rooms, one view. Bucktown, Roosevelt House, their green grass is green, our green grass is brown. Shots rang, my phone wasn't touched on, heavy beef in the street, E.T. had to flee. Great heavens, good grief, hungry bellies, bright gold on their teeth. The windows on the Ave look like sad eyes, the fixed sharp gaze on you when you pass by. And if you dare to stand, you can see him cry, you can watch him scowl, feel him prowl. Wild and steady sizing every inch about you. Fast math measuring what you amount to. The laughter, the screams, the number roll, the song of songs, the book of dreams. Ends don't meet where the arms can't reach. Mean streets, even when it's free, it ain't cheap. Ongoing saga, terminal diagnosis. Basic survival requires super heroics. No space in the budget for a cape. It's when you gotta fly by night to save the day.
That's Life in Marvelous Times by Mos Def, joined by Mr. Flash on that track from the new album, The Ecstatic. Greg, if you go back to 2006's True Magic, it seemed like Mos Def's hip-hop career was over. He was a prime example of the Ice Cube syndrome. The more money his movies made, the worse his music became, until you wondered why he was even bothering. He just phoned that record in. His heart was not in it. This record is a welcome surprise. He seems to really have been enjoying being in the studio. It's not particularly focused, this collection of 16 tracks. It's more like a mixtape. You know, stuff he was doing with various friends at different times. Some great producers, Madlib, and some tracks by the late J Dilla that I guess had been in the can that he added his raps over. And just kind of emptying what's on his mind. He's thinking about everything from, as we just heard, growing up in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, to the injustices of what's happening in the war in Afghanistan. He's all over the map, lyrically and musically, and as a result, it has that kind of spirit of invention that we heard on Black Star in 98.
You know, the one thing that I think Mos Def represented in the late 90s when he emerged was that all bets were off. Hip-hop didn't have to be one thing. It didn't always have to be about bling. It didn't always have to be about these certain kinds of beats. He blew the game wide open in terms of subject matter and the kind of beats he was rapping over. And on this record, he does reclaim that legacy. You know, there's reggae on here, Philly soul, Afrobeat, Bollywood, Euro dance.
Two tracks where he raps in Spanish.
Exactly. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing. But
yeah, I don't think his Spanish is very good.
All over the map. There's even one song where he's got this Turkish acid rock sample playing into a snippet from Mary Poppins, okay?
Yeah.
So the guy is trying out a lot of stuff. Not all of it works, but most of it does. I think he's much more engaged on this record than he has been in a long time. And I got to point out two welcome cameos. We mentioned that earlier in the show about how that's a big part of hip-hop. Mostly this is Mos Def doing what he does best. But it's great to hear Slick Rick again on Auditorium. And it's great to hear Mos Def collaborating with Talib Kweli on History. I think this is a triumphant return to form for Mos Def. I think this is a buy it album all the way.
Buy it, burn it, trash it. That's our rating scale. I concur with you, Mr. Cott. Two enthusiastic buy it. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, I am pleased to announce that we have the mighty Jesus Lizard back on the planet making rock music, and they are in the studio for a live performance and an interview.
Greg, as always, Sound Opinions is produced by our own supergroup, Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. And our fearless leader, our executive producer, the Carl Palmer of Sound Opinions, Tori Southside Malatia.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 1-888-859-1800.
I'm in the phone booth, it's a one across the hall.
Messages. Hi, this is John Kutch from Harvard, Illinois. Can we get a little consistency here, guys? So it's all right, you know, in your first segment of the show to steal songs and MP3s so bands can't make money that way. But then in your second segment following that, Mariah Carey can't sell out in order to make money. That's just wrong and totally not cool. So do you have a magic business plan to, in order, you know, for bands to stay real, besides maybe constant touring? Oh, maybe it's a pledge drive. Well, I don't think that'll work. Maybe Radiohead could pull that off, but that's about it. So I don't know, guys. Maybe you could come up with a consistent position and maybe even a magic new paradigm business plan to share with all the rest of us. Otherwise, swell job. Love you guys lots.
Bye-bye. Hi, my name is Josh. I live in New York. I think your latest Rock Doctor segment is great, but I wanted to give two more recommendations based off of what I heard. For starters, if you almost bought Mastodon, but got a little bit turned off at the end, I Can't Stand Metal with the Screaming Lyrics, but Pelican, in particular the record City of Echoes, is fantastic. It's instrumental post-rock, but it's basically metal without screaming vocalists, and it's the first metal record that I really got. In addition, you also mentioned to him the Alejandro Escovedo record and the Jason Lytle record, and I think the artist that he would really like, if he liked those and based off everything else, although he may know them with his alt-country stuff, is M. Ward. In particular, Duet for Guitars number 2 has those same kind of stories. There's some ties there back to Jason Lytle and Granddaddy and everything else.
Well, were you there, my good man, when the river called the Colorado made the canyon they call gray? Believe me now, my good man, I was there, but now here I am.
That's all. Just wanted to give a little insight and maybe recommend M. Ward and Pelican.
My good man, when the watery volcano exploded into land, believe me now, my good man, I was there, but now here I am.
Me shoot the shoe. He won the local lottery and took us out. We put a barricade down the middle of the bed, but that didn't stop me from looking down the barrel. Well, I thought I was thinking, but apparently not. Well, I thought I was thinking, but apparently not.
Hey guys, this is Kevin from San Diego, California. Jim, I have to call you out regarding the review of the Fiery Furnaces' new album. Now, I'm no big Fiery Furnaces fan, but the reasons you tore down the album seem like the very reasons you love another indie darling, Decemberists. Your description of the Furnaces, quote, hyper-literary assault of words that is just so precious, is exactly how I feel about the annoying, precious crud Colin Molloy records.
Wasn't it a lovely breeze that swept the leaves of arbories and bent to brush our blushing knees? Here we died our little deaths, and we were alive to catch our breath, so swiftly lifting from our chest.
At least the Furnaces have the mercy to do these things in short, digestible bursts. By your description, the supposed orc pop epics of the Decemberists are built on the same things you seem to hate about the fiery furnace. Just my two cents.
Isn't it bad?
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.